Hi, friend. How are you? I'm doing all right. Thanks for asking. I suppose, welcome back. It has been a little while, to say the least. But we're back for season three of The Safe Place. We're joined today by Alice Brackley, who is a personal trainer and adaptive fitness coach, also a certified nutritionist. And that's really important when it comes to Alice, because Alice also has lived experience of eating disorder. Alice tells us about her experiences with living with eating disorder, experience of hospital stays and working through the healthcare system, and how she now uses her own experiences to help others. Quite fitting for this time of year. So let's go straight into hearing from Alice, and let's get comfortable. Sit back and relax, and I welcome you into The Safe Place.
Hello, thank you for having me. My name's Alice, and I am a personal trainer. I'm an adaptive coach, so I work with adults with special needs, and we're also working with children as well, in sort of like local special needs schools now. So that's primarily what I do. I also am an able body coach as well, so I do a bit of both, which is really cool. I've also had a history of an eating disorder, which is something that I also bring into my personal training, and it's obviously like a big part of my coaching around, you know, building that healthy relationship with food and with exercise, which I try and instill in clients, because I think even in this day and age, if you haven't got an eating disorder, there's a lot of disordered eating just because of the society that we live in. So I feel like it gives me another sort of niche to my personal training as well that I like to try and bring across.
Yeah, and it all interests me, the kind of lived experience of people, and it's a lot of what we talk about on the show is kind of how that then interacts with everything that you do. So you having lived with an eating disorder, and you'll have to talk us through a little bit more, but as I understand it, with eating disorders, they kind of are always there in the background. It's always something that you're living with, and it's a way of then dealing with it more effectively and in a more healthy way. Is that essentially kind of right, or am I way off there?
No, that's bang on, really. I always say that when you've struggled with sort of mental health, it is a part of who you are. And when you're going through it, it feels very much like it's you. And a big part of therapy was trying to separate those two people. And the way I kind of describe it now, and also when I'm trying to help other people through it, is that it's almost like there are two voices in your head. And there's for me, there was Alice. And then there was Alice with the eating disorder. And I used to say they were like a scream and a whisper. So obviously at the height of my anorexia, Alice was whispering. She was very quiet. And my eating disorder was very loud. And then as you go through recovery, it's more that the eating disorder becomes the whisper and Alice is now very loud. But there are certain triggers. There are certain times. There are certain scenarios where actually the eating disorder can start to get a little bit louder. And that's when you kind of then pull in your toolkit and go, okay, I'm struggling. I can hear the voice getting louder. Like, how can I manage that now? And how can I control that? So I kind of see them as two people living side by side. One's shouting, one's whispering, and whoever's whispering and whoever is shouting is dependent on who's winning at that point. Obviously, at the height of my anorexic voice, my eating disorder voice won 100% of the time. And then I like to say, as you go through, that kind of shifts a lot, but still, she's still there like 5% of the time now. So 95% of the time, 90% of the time I'm fine and I'm managing. And then certain scenarios, certain life events, you know, day-to-day life stresses, it's kind of a way to cope so that voice can start to get a little bit louder. But it's about being able to acknowledge it, recognize it, and then put those things in place that you know get you out of it.
Yeah, and one of the questions that I often have myself when I kind of think about anorexia, and some of this kind of sort of came from a recent Netflix series, Everything Now, which is obviously based around a girl that lives with anorexia she goes into hospital for it and kind of comes out, and it's all about her life after coming out of hospital and the kind of dynamics of that. And it's funny how these things influence our kind of thought trails. But it always intrigues me and kind of interests me as to kind of what, if anything, was the original trigger for it, or is it more of a thing of that there's so much stuff that just kind of puts down on you and the kind of way that society works, particularly these days with social media. Social media can be fantastic, but equally it can be fairly kind of oppressive and can really shine in some negative light on some of the eating things and the way that we look and that kind of almost requirement to look a certain way. For you then, was it kind of one big thing that kind of kickstarted it, do you think, or was it just all these other things that exist in our society?
I think it's quite interesting because whenever I speak to anyone or whenever anyone speaks to me about my eating disorder, it's one of the first things that they ask. It's always, what caused it? And for a long, long time, it used to really throw me because I almost felt bad that I didn't have a reason. And I almost felt guilty for that. I was almost kind of like, well, I don't know. Like, it just happened. Like, what's wrong with me? Like, nothing's happened terribly to me. And then kind of as I went through therapy, you do a lot of work on, obviously, underlying issues and unpicking. And I think what came to me as I went through my own journey and what I think people find quite shocking now is it originally actually had nothing to do with how I looked and food, which I think is sometimes a bit of a shock to people. But my initial eating disorder actually became apparent to me as a means of control and feeling out of control in other areas of my life. And actually I found that the one thing that I had complete control over was the food that went into my mouth. And then as a consequence of that, I then started to see that I could control my body. And I think a lot of what came from that was this element of security. And in the early stages of an eating disorder, you very much feel like you're in control. I'm deciding what goes into my body. I'm deciding my output with exercise. I'm deciding if I eat that, if I eat that, if I do this, if I do that. And you very much feel like you have a sense of control. And then actually, as you go through, you realize more and more that you have no control. It's controlling you. But initially, it started as a means of control and just as a way of finding something that I knew every day would be the same, because I had very like particular routines and particular things that I had to do. So they were my constants in my day, and everything else was going on around me that I couldn't control, but I had that thing that was mine and I could control it and no one could take that away from me. So actually it was started off kind of more around that. And I think with an eating disorder, there's a lot of research done now, especially into sort of like overlapping things that, you know, it's not just an eating disorder in isolation, and there's lots of other mental health issues that come into it. And another big one was the idea of like perfectionism and kind of that OCD, which is a big thing when you're in your eating disorder. It's kind of like if things aren't perfect, if the conditions aren't perfect, if the food on your plate isn't perfect, you can't eat it. And I actually had, before I had anorexia, I had something called orthorexia, which actually isn't a clinical term at the moment. It's not in the DSM, but it's just an obsession with healthy food. And it's just this idea of like everything that you put into your body is perfect. So, you know, the idea that you can't eat something that's processed, you can't eat packaged food, everything should be like, I wanted to grow my own vegetables. And it was coming from a place of health initially, of like, I wanted everything that went into my body to be perfect because I wanted to control that element. And then slowly, obviously, because that was so restrictive, it then made its way, which is quite natural. I think a lot of people that suffer with anorexia, actually, if you talk to them, they've first had orthorexia. So it's kind of that, again, that control element of like, what is going into my body, I have complete control over, and it has to be perfect, and that's it. So it kind of started very subtly, and then obviously progressed over time.
But it kind of makes sense. I mean, I've briefly talked about it before, but I kind of live at the other end of the spectrum to kind of anorexia, in that I use binge eating as a control mechanism. So particularly when I'm struggling with my mental health, so I've lived with depression and anxiety and personality disorders and lots of lovely stuff, and kind of trauma disorders and stuff, which largely is associated with being disabled and having lots of surgeries and you know, these kind of traumatic events that you don't really think about, or at least I don't. Obviously I should have, but binge eating was a control. It literally allows me to force down, and it's taken a lot of kind of therapy, and it sounds like a similar thing for you, to understand that kind of forcing down of food for me was the mechanism to force down my emotions, so that I then didn't have to deal with them and create a feeling of, for me, it was a kind of feeling of numbness, so that I didn't have that overwhelm. And that was the kind of mechanism to use it. And it's, I think to some people, it might sound odd, but actually it's not that in itself isn't an abnormal thing to kind of go through, to want control over your life and your existence. Obviously it becomes,
yeah, it can be. And like, as humans, we crave stability and we crave comfort. And if there is a time when you're feeling out of control, like, anyone that you speak to will have a means of something that they do when they're in a state of high stress or whatever. And I think people often, like you say, overlook it, because it's not something that then has a negative impact. It might be that you know, it could be anything. It could be absolutely anything. But actually, when you think about it, as humans, we want to feel in control and we want to feel secure. And sometimes those behaviors that we undertake to gain that control then have a negative impact on us. And like you say, like, if you have something that specifically triggers it, I think it's easier to notice when you do those behaviors. But because mine wasn't just like a thing that happened, nothing happened to me. It was just, obviously, these little things had built up over time where I felt out of control, but I didn't realize that I felt out of control. So when I first started to control the food, I didn't even realize that I was doing it. And in the same breath, neither did anyone around me. It was just, oh, you know, Alice, she just likes to eat healthily. She likes to do this. She's, you know, she loves the gym. She loves fitness. She loves, at the time I was running, and, you know, she needs to eat like that because she's running all these miles. Like, even everyone around me at the start didn't realize that it was a means of control and that it was going to spiral into what it spiraled into. At first it was kind of celebrated. It was kind of, you know, Alice was the fitness freak that went running and did all these miles, so it's only natural that she doesn't want to eat a chocolate bar, which is quite normalized in our society, which is why I think for eating disorders and especially anorexia, it can go unnoticed for quite some time. And it's what I speak about a lot in terms of treatment and recovery, in that you cannot look at somebody and tell that they have anorexia by their body. And it's a big thing in recovery, and it's a big thing in getting treatment, that I think a lot of us are still working to get in diminished, because it comes a lot from BMI, and you can be overweight and have anorexia. And I think that shocks people as well, because I think the stereotype of anorexia, and I think even still now, the stereotype of anorexia, which annoyingly I obviously fit the bill, is this young, blonde, petite girl. And that was the criteria. That was almost how you felt you had to look to have anorexia. And it's just not the case. As I say, you can be any BMI, any body weight, and be anorexic, because anorexia is a mental illness and it is behaviors. You don't have to be underweight to have anorexia. Mentally, but in terms of treatment, low body weight has to be there for you to gain treatment. So there's the real big divide between, you know, people feeling like they have to get to their worst actually before they can get help, which happened to me myself. Like I went to, for help, and I was told that I was too big for help, which is crazy.
Wow. And this is a very personal question, and if it's too close to the bone, then just say. But how big were you at, or big's not the right word, but what kind of size were you? What kind of physical state were you at that point where you weren't allowed help?
So to get help from the NHS, your BMI has to be below 15, which is super low. And for me, that was under 5 stone at that point. And my BMI was 15.1 when I first went to the doctors for help. So I didn't meet the criteria to be referred. And they said that if I was referred, it wouldn't get looked at because they basically, the way I saw it is that they go filter 15, you're not in 15, you're not going to get help. And obviously at that point as well, it had taken a lot of courage for me to go to the doctors at this point. My family had been asking me for pretty much a year at this point to go and get help. And in my head, I wasn't unwell. And that's another big barrier with anorexia. I didn't see that what I was doing was a problem. So in my head, I wasn't unwell. I finally went to the doctors, and in my head, the doctor said, "Don't know why you're here. You're not unwell." So they just affirmed to me what I thought was true. So then I went home and I went, "I don't know what you're all talking about, because the doctors have told me I'm fine." Obviously, that's not what they were saying at all. But in the state that I was in, being told that you're too big for treatment, all I heard was, "You're not underweight, you're still overweight," which actually led me to go on to lose quite a significant amount of weight again in a short space of time, because I was like, well, the only way I can get help is if I get my body weight even lower. So I'm going to do even more exercise and eat even less than I already am, because it's the only way I'm going to get help. So they're kind of pushing you at the moment to a point of being on your deathbed, which is essentially what they did to me before I was able to actually get into services and get help, which is heartbreaking.
And then presumably that ends up in a longer spell in hospital, as an example, because you've got to the point where your body is so unwell, it's malnourished, maybe the wrong word to use, but
that's the right word to use. You are absolutely malnourished at that point.
and that. That's always something that you see kind of adverts for kind of foreign nations, as an example, where they have serious limitations on the food that they can access, and you see people that are exceptionally kind of malnourished, and we use that term a lot, and it's a tragic thing to see, and it's all about help, but then we don't seem to have that same mechanism, by the sound of it, until it's almost too late in our kind of mental health service and kind of wider service. Slightly boggles my mind.
I was given, when I eventually got to the hospital and they eventually took me in, I had the first thing they did was link me up to an ECG, and they gave me an ECG, and I just remember these doctors like rushing in. I was like, my dad was sat outside and my mum was in the room with me, and 4 or 5 doctors rushed in, and then they kind of like walked back out and were like, "Oh no, it's fine, it makes sense." And I was like, "What's going on?" And they basically said at that point they couldn't find a heartbeat. My heart was so weak at that point that it wasn't being picked up. And obviously when that sent alarm bells to people outside of the room, and then when they saw me, they were like, "Okay, it makes sense, that's why you can't." So and at that point they said that if I carried on the way that I was with the routine that I had 2 weeks left to live. And at that point you've kind of gone, but I asked for help. I'm now knocking on death's door. I asked for help weeks ago and this could have been avoided. But like I say, and I know that myself and the hundreds of people that have gone through the services and the people that I met in hospital, they all felt this exactly the same way that I did. They felt that they had to push themselves to that that desperation level of, okay, we have to take them now because otherwise they're going to die, to actually get heard, which is, you know, it's heartbreaking in itself, but it's also, it perpetuates the problem of mental illness, because, you know, we bang on about it's a mental illness, it can't be seen, not all disabilities are visible, yet every single girl that I met, and I must admit I only met girls, but obviously it affects males as well, every single girl in there said that they weren't taken seriously until their body matched their brain, and it shouldn't be that way. It just shouldn't, because like I've said a million times, anorexia is a mental illness. So there shouldn't be a body shape or body weight that determines how unwell you are. I did the same behaviors at 5 stone as I did when I was 10 stone, but they were only taken seriously when I was 5 stone. I was almost congratulated for those behaviors when I was 10 stone, because it was kind of like, oh, wow, you're so disciplined. You're so motivated. I wish I had your willpower. And I did the same things when I was 5 stone. And it was, this is ridiculous. You're going too far. How are you still doing this? And it's like, it's very confusing to somebody whose brain is not obviously working correctly at that point, because you're so malnourished, your brain, your cognitions, everything else is just gone. And it's like, hang on, I was doing this when I was bigger and no one batted an eyelid. Everyone was praising me. And now I'm still doing these things. And now I'm finally, it almost feels like you get taken seriously eventually, but it shouldn't have to be that way. It shouldn't have to be that you have a certain body to be taken seriously for a mental illness.
Yeah. And it is a tragic state. And the kind of the issue ultimately is funding for mental health services as a whole. I mean, I've been at significantly low points in my life where, had it not been for having private health cover, I would not be around.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Yeah.
Because the access to the NHS at that point, it was COVID as well, so it really wasn't a good time to have a kind of serious dip in my mental health. Because services just weren't operating in the same way. It really is a wider issue, and the fact that it's then leading to people being so close to death ultimately is a tragic thing. And kind of when you were then, so you got into hospital.
Yeah,
you were in hospital for about a year.
Probably a year and a half in total. And then, so my story through hospital is always a little bit different, because ironically at that point I was living in London, because this actually, my eating disorder started whilst I was at uni, which is another thing that I talk about with the control. I was going through uni at the time, and I think I was just so scared about doing well at uni, like, again, it was a way to alleviate some of that pressure. I was living in London, so obviously I'd gone to my GP in London, and I was referred to an eating disorder unit in London, and they had a bed for me, which is pretty unheard of, to get a bed straight away, and also one so local, because a lot of girls that I met had actually been sent, you know, like miles and miles away from home, because it was kind of, there's a bed in this hospital and you have to take it. So the fact that there was a bed local and that it was there and they were willing for me to take that bed, but I was very adamant that I didn't want to be an inpatient. So there's lots of levels of sort of care when you're struggling, and inpatient is obviously what is given to you straight away. It's, you know, you live at the hospital, and you're very much, everything is done there, and you just kind of get put in and that's it. I was very adamant that I didn't want to be an inpatient. I'm not really sure why, but I just know that I didn't want to be an inpatient. I think at the time my parents were very much of a different mindset. They were kind of like, get her into hospital, we want her there all the time, she needs to be looked after. So at this point, I decided to, probably not my wisest choice, and I do not recommend this to anyone, I discharged myself from services because I wanted to move home and I wanted to be treated at home. Now, I was very naive, didn't really have much to do with like doctors and how things worked. I thought that because I'd been accepted into the service, I could just move home and I would just pick up where I was here, go home and continue my recovery at home. Obviously, that's not how it works. And so I discharged myself and went home, and they were like, well, you've got to start the process again. And I was like, oh, that's not how I planned this to go. And obviously at this point, my parents had just been told that I had 2 weeks left to live. I'm now out of services, out of any form of care at all. So they went into complete panic mode of like, we need to get her into hospital. So there was a lot of A&E trips in this time. They were just desperate. They were just saying, but I actually studied psychology at university and my dissertation was on eating disorders. And I was obviously at this point, I was over 18. So I'm an adult, and my parents were there saying to the doctors and stuff like, she knows what to say. Like what she's saying isn't the truth. She knows exactly what you're going to ask her. She knows what you're going to say in a psych assessment. She knows what answers to give to not get her put in hospital. And I get it from their point of view. They were like, our hands are tied, because I had never, at this point, I had never had any history of self-harm. So they didn't deem me to be a danger to myself. So at that point as well, my parents were like, is anorexia not a form of self-harm? Like she's willingly not. But because I had never physically hurt myself or anybody else, how you want to define that is up for question. But in the eyes of A&E, I wasn't a risk to myself or anyone else, so they couldn't section me. So my parents kept taking me in, I kept coming out, taking me in. It was just a revolving door of kind of them doing that until I eventually got back into the services. So when I finally got into hospital, I went as what they call a day patient. So I was there for all my meals, there for my therapy, but I got to sleep at home essentially. So it was kind of the one down to be an inpatient. So I ate there, did my therapy there, spent all day there. And then I'd get picked up at night, come home, sleep in my own bed, and then get dropped back in the morning. And that was what I did for just over a year. And then I went to an outpatient for sort of a couple of months when I decided that I was ready to try and integrate back into society. So in total, yeah, it was around a year and a half, but it was kind of, I never went inpatient, which for me was really important. I know that for some people it's the only option, but I wanted the opportunity to not do that. So it was very much like, we'll allow you to do the day patient as long as your weight stays the same and then starts to increase. Yeah. If my weight starts to go down further, then it would have been taken out of my hands and I would have become an inpatient. So so I did all of my therapy, all of my eating in the hospital, but I just got to sleep in my own bed, which was very important to me at that time. And I just didn't want to be an inpatient. I didn't want to be around it 24/7, weirdly.
I can understand for sure. I mean, I think there's always a thing about the comfort of your own bed, home, you know, whatever that might be for the individual, that a hospital setting, no matter how nice the hospital, just never meets ultimately.
Definitely not.
Tell me a little bit about the therapy that you kind of went through, and what was that experience like?
So initially there was obviously a massive focus on food. They, when you're underweight, they're first and foremost, their biggest thing is to just get you to a healthy weight, which is obviously quite a mean feat in itself, because you're battling against a brain that hasn't been able to recover yet. And so it's a lot of, I don't want to say force feeding, however, to a degree it's force feeding. You know, you the hospital that I was at, you got a 2 week, what they call a 2 week grace period, where you could leave food on your plate. And then once your 2 weeks was up, you had to clear your plate. So it was very much just like breakfast, snack, lunch, snack, and then a meal, a cooked meal. And yeah, it was very much just like the first like sort of few weeks of being there. It's not a lot of therapy. There's just more like eat this, sit with the feeling, you know, you kind of have to eat, and then you go into a room and you're not allowed to be on your own because of, you know, purging and things like that. So it's just very like micromanaged at that point. And then I was involved with the unit that I was in. I had a mix of like one-to-one and group therapy. So the group therapy was like, you know, CBT stuff, and a lot of talking therapy. And we used to do like scrapbooking and things like that. So it was very practical, very hands-on, which I actually kind of enjoyed that side of it, because I think it was easier to talk about things if your hand and your mind were busy. Like sometimes you just end up talking about things without even realizing. And then I obviously had one-to-one therapy as well. So, you know, we covered a lot of topics around sort of body image, self-esteem, you know, food rules, habits, behaviors, all of that thing. Like it was all very much challenged. But then I think the scrapbooking one I used to quite enjoy as well, because it was a lot of sort of look into the future, of like when you're out of this, like what do you want to achieve? And it was a lot of like forward planning and also a lot of like retrospect, like what would you say to future Alice? What would you say to past Alice and things like that? And if you had to write a letter to yourself in 5 years' time, what do you hope you would see and things like that? So it was a lot of like forward planning. And it's actually quite a nice thing to have now, because I still have my scrapbook. I actually did that therapy twice. I went through the process twice. So I have my two scrapbooks. It's quite nice to sometimes randomly will just get it out and have a look at it. And it's quite eye-opening to see what my thought processes used to be like, because I don't know if, you know, you've struggled with your own mental health. Like my memory from that time is actually quite blurred, and there's quite a lot of at my very low parts, like there's quite a lot of things that I actually don't remember, things that like family members and friends would say to me, and I'd go, I do not remember that happening. So it's kind of quite nice sometimes, because I think it's hard to sometimes look back and remember how far you've come, because you kind of block out the very worst. So it's almost kind of like I've got it there on paper of like actually where I've come from is so far removed from where I am now, which is obviously nice, but it's also a good resource when I was having, I know we touched on it before we started recording about like my relapse, and it was quite nice to have that there again to go, I've been in this place before and it seemed impossible, but I did get out of it. So it kind of gave you that resource there as well to go, you've been here before, but you know you can get out of it, even though it feels impossible right now. And also it's quite nice because there were things in there that I wanted to tick off and I've been able to, which is nice. Like it's kind of like, oh, you know, those little things in recovery that pushed me through in the early stages, to be able to say that I'm doing them now is like one of those big wins of recovery. So it's nice to have that contrast and that reminder of where you've come from.
It sounds like a book of hope to me.
Yeah,
be it hope from the time that you were experiencing it, or hope for the future. I mean, that sounds like a lovely, cherished thing to have.
Yeah, and it's something that I recommend, because I also volunteer with BEAT, the Eating Disorder Charity. So I've done a lot of things in the past to sort of raise money for them, but I'm part of an initiative that they've started now. It's basically for people like myself that were out of treatment and waiting for treatment. You almost become a bit like a pen pal, but it's via email. And it's just, you get sort of matched up with someone who has had a similar experience to yourself. So I kind of, when I went into it, I said, obviously I've struggled with anorexia and XYZ, and then they match you up with somebody, and it's just a way for them to kind of get down how they're feeling to somebody who has been through what they've been through, and obviously yeah. kind of give them hope and things like that. And I always, anyone that I've been matched with, I'm always like, make it like a weekly thing, because I think people throw around journaling, and I think people quite struggle quite a lot with journaling, like where to start.
It's hard.
It's a really hard thing to do, but actually I feel like the scrapbook way of journaling is actually quite nice, because it's almost like you can pick a topic. So we used to have like a topic each week. So it might be like one week, it might have been scrapbook, a day with anorexia and a day without. And I'd come up with all these ideas of like, so in the on the anorexia side, there was all words like I'd done like rain clouds, and everything was black and white and monochrome, and out of the rain clouds was coming all of these negative words. And then on the other page, it was like a beach, and it was all vibrant and happy, and there was these other, like there was all these vibrant words and happy words, and it was colorful. And it was just a really easy way to almost journal without having to write loads, because I used to really struggle with writing down how I felt. But actually being able, it was really silly, but it also was like therapy to me. I used to look forward to my like weekly visits to like Hobbycraft, getting all my things from my scrapbook, and it was a good distraction. It was an easy way to get out how I was feeling without having to one say it or write it. It was just a way to me to like visualize how I felt. So I always say to people, if they're struggling with journaling, like it's a really, really nice way to get into it. And then as you get more comfortable with like expressing how you feel, you can then move into maybe writing things down and X, Y, Z. But I think people find drawing, I'm not a drawer, like I'm not an artist. So I liked the scrapbooking because the drawing was done for me. Like I could go and if I wanted to put a cloud there, I'd go and find someone who had made a cloud and I'd stick it in, because the perfectionist side of me would not have coped with trying to draw a cloud and it not being right and blah, 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 blah. So the fact that it was all external things that I could go and find and put down on a piece of paper, it really helped me to get my emotions out and express how I was feeling without having to write like these lengthy journals that I just couldn't relate to it at the start. So it was a really like entry level way into journaling almost.
And I think it's important for people to understand that there are, yeah, because journaling, like you say, is this thing that has been made to be the must do for everybody, and the almost yeah. feeling like if you don't do it, you're kind of failing. And it's that yeah. kind of slightly misguided discussion around journaling being the answer to everything, and it's helpful, very, very helpful, can be, but like everything, it's not for everybody. And no. yeah, I mean I struggle with journaling, so I will sit there and not write anything. So what yeah. I tend to do is I'll write a poem. So I'm yeah. they're terrible poems, they're rubbish, they're, you know, my 6-year-old son could probably do better, sort of thing. But it's my way of having the connection, because my mind's really jumbled.
Yeah.
So I have lots of different thoughts going on all at the same time, and trying to unpick that can be really difficult. So having that kind of poem structure, it just means that I can throw words out and actually they kind of make sense in a weird sort of way.
Yeah.
But in the structure of a poem, it allows me to do that rather than sitting there trying to write out this big, you know, essay of stuff. And I like writing. Yeah, I mean, I kind of do it for a job pretty much, and that everything I do is associated to writing. So yeah, it's something I should be good at, but emotions are hard. They're tough to recognize and deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. Like writing down, I always say, like when it's about something else, I can talk and write for hours. When it's about your own emotions, it's like they're all in here, but like you say, getting it from here to the paper is quite difficult, and it's something that yeah. I really struggled with. Again, I think it came down, like I said before, like kind of that perfectionist as well. Like if I wrote something down and it wasn't quite right, I'd rather just not write it down, the fear of that being wrong. And then I kind of, that's where I went from like scrapbooking. I then went into like brain dumping rather than journaling. Yeah. And it was like this spider diagram, and it didn't need to be neat. It didn't need to be like, I would get to a point where I'd have a journal and I'd write a couple of words and I hadn't done it in my neatest handwriting, and I'd be rubbing it out and trying to write it again. And I'm like, this is not what journaling is about. This is not what it's supposed to do. Like, I'm not supposed to get anxious about writing my journal with the fear of making a spelling mistake or, you know, I don't know, doing something wrong. And it just didn't work for me. So having images and that visual just works so much better for me. And it's something that I recommend to like people that I've spoken to and worked with so far. And it seems to always be really positively received, and kind of like they'll come back and say, oh, I tried it and like it was so good. And it was nice, like I say, to have like a focus each week of like, you know, who are you without your eating disorder was always a good one. And who are you without your mental illness? Because I think a lot of your identity can become tied into your mental illness. Especially with an eating disorder, I had a lot of people sort of answering for me of like, you know, oh, Alice won't eat that. Alice wouldn't do that. Alice would never do that. And actually there was Alice inside screaming, going, but I really want to, but you're stopping me from doing that now because I've got this persona of someone who wouldn't do that. And it kind of fed into like the gym as well, of like, if there was a morning when I really, really didn't want to go to the gym, my anorexia would be saying, you have to go. And then there'd also be this voice going, everyone expects you to go because you're Alice that goes to the gym every day. So your whole identity becomes about it. So actually, when you then try and recover from it, I was like, well, if I don't have my eating disorder, what do I have? I'm nothing without my eating disorder, because that's what everyone knows me for. I'm that girl that runs for miles and, you know, doesn't eat a crisp at the family party. Like, if I don't do that, then who am I? So it's a really nice way to sort of like engage back with who you are outside of your struggles, and who you are and who you want to be outside of your illness, because they are very all consuming, as you probably know yourself. Like, they are everything. It's from the minute you wake up to the minute you go to bed, it's pretty much all you think about. So yeah, you kind of lose your way a little bit in that. And I think it's a really nice way of just being able to reconnect with who you are as a person outside of it.
Yeah, and I resonate tremendously with that. And I think one of the images I often have in my head, because I do tend to have a lot of imagery when, I experience something called dissociation. So I kind of basically go off into my own little world. It's a kind of a protectionist thing in my brain to let me escape and let me just have a bit of freedom, I guess. But it's not ultimately not a healthy way of coping, because you're not present. But I have this kind of image of me, so me as in Gavin, the kind of true me, in this little tiny almost pin dot of a kind of person, and this big kind of all-consuming shadow that is then this kind of giant version of me that isn't really me. It's in the shadows. It's away from kind of reality. But that's the kind of me that more often people see. And it can be really hard for people to understand that you're kind of struggling against a persona that might have been created for you. You might have created yourself. So for me, it was more again a protection thing for me, that I created a certain persona, that I was very practical, that I was very safe, that I was very, you know, kind of good in the kind of sense of that I would kind of follow, I would do what I was meant to do, and all these kind of things. But actually, that there is elements, of course, of me in that, and they're just massively over-magnified.
Yeah.
Really, that's not the core me. The core me is fun and likes to have joy and experience kind of cool things, and is a joker and is daft and silly. It's not the ultra, overly intelligent, overly kind of knobby version that I have to portray, because that's what I felt like I had to portray.
It's quite interesting because I think I often portrayed myself as like at the early stages of someone that was like super health conscious, and obviously as I became more unwell, it was actually the people around me were trying to protect me, because if someone didn't quite know what I was going through and they sort of offered me something, I remember once being at a family party, and quite often during recovery I might have woken up that morning and gone, do you know what, I'm going to a family party later, like I'm going to challenge myself to eat one of my fear foods when I'm at the party, because you'll quite often find that someone struggling with anorexia will have their own set of foods that they feel safe and that are fear foods, and you know, I would have been at that party and that food could have been offered to me, and before I have the chance to go, yes, I'm gonna take one, my mum, dad, friend, whoever was there would swoop in and go, oh no, Alice won't eat that. And from their mind, they were doing that from a place of love, of trying to protect me, of they didn't want me to feel uncomfortable and like I had to say yes to them or I had to take it. But actually, at times, it actually inhibited my recovery, because I was like, in my own head, I was like, actually, I was about to take that, but you're right, Alice doesn't eat that, so I'm not going to eat that. Like, and I'd kind of go, oh my God, I nearly slipped up on my anorexia then. Like, and then I'd have the conversation of, but you want to slip up on your anorexia because that isn't healthy. But so you're very much in this like brainwashed state sometimes of like the tipping scales constantly of, you know, like I said at the very, very start of the volume of the voices, at the start, Alice would shout, then anorexia would shout, then Alice would shout, then anorexia would shout. And I'd be like, I don't know who to listen to. Like, I don't know who's winning here, because they were both kind of fighting against each other. They were both screaming. And actually, the more times that you're able to go, even if anorexia is screaming, the more times you're able to go against what she's saying, the quieter she eventually gets over time. But obviously, when you're challenging those thoughts in the very start, it's just this screaming match going on in your head. And again, that's the part that nobody sees. That's the mental side of it that nobody sees, because the amount, I always used to say, if I had a little speaker that I could click onto my head, into my brain and project out, even for half an hour, I don't think people quite truly understand what goes on in there at times. I don't think that they would, unless there was a way I could get that out. I said, like, most of the time you'll see this deadpan Alice face, you know, and you'll just think, oh, she's picking up a sandwich. But actually, if you could hear the internal conversation that's happening to pick up that sandwich of, I actually recently spoke about this on my Instagram stories, because I've had quite a few times in supermarkets where I've probably looked very suspicious to start. And I spoke about it recently, that I had a security guard like following me around basically, because I was picking up food, putting it back on the shelf and blah, blah, blah. And actually it was just me trying to decide what I wanted to eat, but the voices in my head were all saying different things. And I quite often say the amount of times that I stand in front of a meal deal and I'm like, okay, I want that sandwich, but that one's got less calories, but I actually don't like that one. I want this one. So maybe I'll just pick up this one. Oh, but actually, maybe I should just go for a wrap because a wrap's got less calories. Or maybe I should go for a salad. Or maybe I'll get pasta. I should just get the sandwich that I wanted in the start. Like, and all of this conversation is happening, and all the outside world is seeing is a girl standing in front of a meal deal stand going, what sandwich do I want? But actually that internal conversation of all of these voices going, you want this, but get that, but have this, but don't have that. That would be there all of the time. And obviously it's a lot less frequent now, but even now, I'm coming up to nearly a decade of recovery. Even now, those conversations do still happen. And sometimes I do have to fight a little bit harder to pick up the sandwich that I want and not the one that my head is saying I should get. But I think it's quite interesting, really. And I quite often say, like I say, if I could have a little microphone that I stuck into my brain, I think people would I think they'd be quite shocked sometimes of like the battles that go on inside your head, but to the outside world, you're just this person standing in front of a sandwich stand. Like, it's quite interesting, really.
Sounds like something off of Bridget Jones. That last bit. I'm just a woman standing in front of a sandwich stand.
Honestly.
I really enjoy kind of listening to and kind of seeing your stories and kind of seeing what you kind of put out there on Instagram, because I say it's different to my experiences. I think that it always is, because again, if you live with the same condition, and this extends out from to physical disabilities as well as experiencing mental health illnesses, everyone's experience is always a bit different. But I kind of resonate with a lot of what you say from a different perspective, in that kind of dialogue that you talk about. I've constantly got that going on.
Yeah.
And I kind of have it whereas I'm the kind of separate person to these different dialogues. And for me, it's usually about four or five different dialogues going on at kind of one time. And it basically ends up kind of turning into this mass scale war of this image that I kind of have in my head. It's like trying to describe that to somebody. The closest I can describe it as is go and watch Braveheart and look at the two competing kind of battles, the kind of big battles in that film. And it's kind of like that, but with at least two other armies that are involved, all kind of competing and clashing, and then the kind of survivor at the end of it is the one that kind of gets it. And you have to kind of then question that, because actually, obviously, that's all fabrication in your own mind. And it's that kind of constant questioning, constant realization and understanding of well, okay, I can step back from that, and actually I am me, I can take my own decisions, I can make my own thoughts.
Yeah.
I find that very exhausting. Do you find similar with your kind of discussions, internal dialogue?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing that makes it really difficult, and I don't know whether this is the same for yourself, but for me, it's the same voice. It's all my voice. I hear all of these, so that it's the same voice, but it's different people, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So actually then deciphering which person is me, because it's basically like there's all these different people, but they've all got my mask on, and I have to figure out who's wearing the mask and who's me, because to the outside, they're all me. It's all my voice. There's not different voices in my head. There's like a man's voice, a child's voice. It's all Alice. Every single voice sounds the same. And it's in those moments, it's exhausting to, like you say, to pick out which one is actually me, like which one is actually Alice and which one is not. Because, and I think that's what people don't understand, because they're like, well, just pick what you want. And I'm like, but I don't know which one is me anymore. And especially as I got further into my illness, and then it became more natural to me to have these voices, it really did become difficult to figure out what my values were. And a lot of therapy was actually, like I said, going back to finding out who I was and what I wanted and what I enjoyed. Because even now, there are still foods that I don't eat, and I'm unsure of whether I don't like them or whether my eating disorder doesn't like them. So even 6, 7, 8, 9 years post being in hospital, I'm still eating foods for the first time. And one of those was red meat. I had told myself that I didn't like red meat, and I just didn't like it. I don't like burgers. I don't like this. And then the more I thought about it, I was like, do I dislike red meat, or was I just so convinced that I didn't like red meat? Because it's easier for me to say, oh, I don't like that, rather than say,
yeah,
I've got an eating disorder, I can't eat that. I would just say, I don't like it. Chocolate cake. I used to tell everyone that I didn't like chocolate cake, because most people for their birthday would have a cake. So if I said I don't like chocolate cake, if they had a chocolate cake, that was a really easy way for me to not have a slice of cake. I wanted that slice of cake. So there's still things now that I'm still foods that I'm working through, and it's kind of like I have to eat them a few times and go, actually, no, I don't like the taste of that. Because there's a few foods where I'm like, do I not like the taste of that? Or am I just telling myself I don't like the taste of that because I've restricted it for so long because it was on my banned list? So it's really like interesting. So a lot of like my later recovery, and I actually put a post out, I think it was yesterday, something on my story that I shared around full recovery, around sort of like the mental and the physical side of things. Because, you know, I went into hospital, I gained weight and I became a healthy weight. And for a lot of people, they were like, oh, she's cured. She looks great. She's a healthy weight again. Her BMI's up, everything's fine. And actually gaining weight is the easiest thing in eating disorder recovery. It's the first thing and it's the easiest thing in terms of the speed of which it happens. Because especially if you're in a unit that is feeding you, I had no longer had control over my body weight. You know, they gave me the food, I ate it. The only thing that was going to happen was that I was going to gain weight. It's very black and white. You eat food, you gain weight. Very simple. And actually, as you start to gain weight, that in itself breeds a whole nother round of like emotions, negative thoughts, and all of this thing. Because the way that I saw it, because a lot with anorexia, you also have body dysmorphia. So the way that I saw myself was not the body that I actually had. And in my head, when I was at my lowest weight, I was overweight. So if I was putting on weight, I must now be absolutely ginormous, which is silly because I absolutely wasn't. But in my head at that time, you know, I was overweight already. You're making me eat and I'm already overweight because that's all I could see. So then you get all of these other negative emotions of, you know, kind of things that you then have to deal with. So I say that the physical recovery of anorexia is so minor in the grand scheme of things, actually the mental recovery side of things and the internal recovery, because the damage that you do to the inside of your body, not eating, and all of those things can take years. I'm still struggling with things now that are a direct consequence of my eating disorder, yet no one would know that because it's all internal and it's not, you know, all that people see now is a girl that's in a healthy body weight. So they think, oh, she's fine. But actually, you know, when relapses happen and things like that, that's when you know that internally things aren't always fine. And actually there's a lot of work to be done around that. So I think that's a big, big stigma of mental illness anyway, is that it's a look. You look a certain way, you know, if you're depressed, you're locked in a room crying, when actually most of the time people are out and about going to work, doing everyday things and still have depression. Like, it's not a look, and you can't just go by a house. So yeah, I think that's a big, big thing with eating disorders, especially because there is such a stigma around how you look. So but yeah, again, it's kind of that fight between sort of the eating side of it and the mental side of it, which, you know, it seems to be the biggest barrier with mental illness in general, of looks versus internal dialogues and how you feel and everything else, which.
Yeah. And it's an interesting thing from my own perspective, in that. So I after working with a therapist and psychiatrist for a couple of years, it was kind of discovered that I almost definitely have had depression, amongst other things, for at least 30 years. So from the majority of my life, and that it was almost definitely as a result of, growing up with lower limb issues and some kind of bullying stuff and all that sort of stuff, which is kind of secondary to the point. But nobody, and I mean nobody, questioned whether I was feeling low, whether I was feeling unwell, whether I was feeling depressed or anxious, because I became very, 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 very good at what I would term as masking. So putting a kind of a metaphorical mask on, and in many ways kind of physical mask, in that I learned to adjust my features to show that I was okay, and that I was fine, or that I was happy, and that I was enjoying experiences, when actually inside I was kind of dead, really, and that I didn't really have a lot of emotion for a long time. And then eventually all that kind of came pouring out, because all that masking does, all that kind of hiding it does, is mean that at some point it then bursts, the seams come undone, the wall comes down, whatever description you want to use of it, and then everything kind of comes out. And obviously for depression in particular, that's when it's very, very, very dangerous, because that's when you have things like suicidal ideation and active suicidal thoughts, and the most tragic being that you end up taking or attempting your own life. And it's a difficult thing when you aren't, particularly when you're not trained or when you haven't experienced it, to really understand that. And I think it does take people like yourself talking about your experiences for people to start getting a kind of glimpse of what that could look like. But also that just because somebody's really skinny doesn't necessarily mean that they're anorexic as well. And that actually it's a mental illness rather than somebody that, you know, you see marathon runners as an example who run crazy distances all the time, and just to maintain weight, they have to eat thousands and thousands of calories a day, and they still look relatively skinny. And I'm using inverted commas for those not watching. And yeah, those two things don't necessarily then mean that person has got a mental illness, but that's their job. That's their job to run these big distances. Yeah. So you also have to kind of have it with a degree of understanding that just because you meet a visual look doesn't mean that you then meet a mental illness. And as you said at the start, it's also the other way around. Go on.
Yeah, I think when I finally got discharged from hospital, I've always wanted to go traveling. Like, it's anyone who knows me now, I'm the girl that goes traveling. And I had one of my scrapbooks pages was all of the places that I wanted to visit in the future and all these things that I wanted to do. And when I came out of hospital and I got discharged, the first thing that I did was go traveling. Like, that was it. I was coming out of hospital, I was getting myself well to go traveling. And I actually went to America, and I lived and worked in America for the summers. And it was quite, now looking back on it, at the time I didn't actually realize, but looking back on it now, it's quite interesting to see, because to the outside world, I'd been stuck in hospital for a year and a half. I'd come out, I'd done a bit of work, I'd got myself healthy, and I was now living in America, and everyone was like, this is amazing, like, you've completely turned your life around, you know, you're doing the best thing ever now, like, you've done it, you've smashed it, you've recovered, you've done everything. And that equally was probably some of the worst times of my life. And it was, you know, again, like you say, with the masking, I kind of felt like I needed to do this and show that I was living the best life ever, because, you know, I had this goal of getting better and going traveling, and I put all these pictures up of all these wonderful things that I was doing. And actually I'd gone full circle, and I was struggling with binge eating at this point. And so I was still very much ingrained in an eating disorder, just a very different eating disorder. But because it was an eating disorder that made me gain weight, everyone thought I was healthy and happy, and she's eating and she's fine. To the point where I actually ended up in hospital in America because I was so unwell. And no one ever knew about that. I never even told anybody. Obviously my parents knew, but to end up in a psychiatric hospital in a foreign country where you're posting all these pictures of your recovered self, it was very like, it kind of is very, very telling of mental illness, because to the outside world and to everyone else, I'd come out of hospital and I was doing everything that I said I wanted to do. And yet I'm sitting in a hospital bed in a foreign country, waiting for a psych assessment. And, you know, no one would ever have known that. And I never posted that anywhere and I never documented that that happened. So if you go back through my, at the time it was Facebook, I didn't really post on Instagram back then, but at the time it was Facebook, and I had all these photo albums because I know that back in the day, it was kind of every day that you went out was a photo album. I was of that generation. So you go back through my Facebook from sort of 2017, 2018, I look like I'm having the best time ever. I'm in a healthy body. I've gained weight. I'm in a foreign country. I'm living my best life, to quote, you know, and actually there was a lot of internal battles, which then when I returned and we went into lockdown, then manifested again as an anorexia relapse. So, you know, again, like you say, it's you cannot base mental illness on the way someone looks or the way they portray themselves, because like you, I had this mask on of I need to show everyone that I've done it. I've conquered anorexia. I've beaten it. And I almost felt like this pressure to go out and do something quite big and telling. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to go and travel, like I said I was going to. And then actually having to step back and go, actually, I'm not as recovered as you all think I am, felt impossible. And it wasn't until a couple of years later that I was actually able to then start speaking out about my struggles with mental illness, because I just feel like, I'm lucky. I say that I'm lucky. I'm lucky that I've experienced it. I've gone through it and I still struggle with it, but I'm lucky that I'm able to speak about it. And I know not everybody is. And there was a big part of me that just felt that, like, if I had this chance to speak about it, it might make even one person, if one person sees my story and one person sees what I've been through and thinks, okay, like, I'm not alone in this, like, it's worth it. And I just kind of, it was then that I started to see actually that the only way we were going to overcome these stigmas were to talk about it and were to speak out and share actually the reality of living with a mental illness. Because for me, I think I very much went into hospital with the mindset that I was going to get cured and I was going to be fully recovered. And sort of as I went through therapy, I came to the realization, and I actually think it was one of the things that helped me to recover to the point I am now, of actually, I'm going to live with this. I am going to have it with me at all times. And I think that actually did help me recover, because full recovery felt so out of reach to me. So it just felt like I was constantly in this revolving door of like, I'm never going to reach full recovery, so why am I bothering? But actually, when I released those reins a little bit and went, okay, maybe it's going to be with me forever, so how can I live with this for the rest of my life? How can I manage it? How can I, you know, 90% of the time be in control of it? And that actually allowed me to then recover. And I think that's a really important thing that I try and spread, is that someone can be out of hospital for 10, 15, 20, 30 years and may still have dips in their mental health, and that's completely normal. And you may still, I used to say, like, dance with anorexia. Like, there'll be days when I'll do a couple of things that actually are quite restrictive, but it's about being able to go, oh, hang on, that was a little bit restrictive. Let's not make a habit of that. Let's make sure tomorrow we don't do that again, or, you know. And I think that's something that I try and get across, that I'm not fully recovered in the sense of I don't think I ever will be. But I am recovered to a point where it no longer rules my life. And I'm okay with that. And I think that was a big, big breakthrough in my recovery.
Yeah, and I think this is where mental illness is very difficult to physical illness, in that there are, I mean, saying that there's many physical illnesses that you also don't fully recover from, and I am a living example of that, in that you're never quite the same after breaking an ankle or whatever it might be. But then, yeah, if you bruise yourself, your body heals, it recovers. Whereas people that everyone that I've met that's gone through a mental illness or lives with a mental illness, everyone has talked about the same thing, in that whilst we get to a point, like you say, where we feel comfortable, we feel happy, we feel like we are in a manageable and livable place that we can live with whatever's going on, and that we are, I can describe it as a safety. So I feel safe now, whereas I didn't feel safe, kind of 2 or 3 years ago. But I know that I will always have depression, and that I will always have this personality disorder, and probably some other things that haven't even been talked about yet. Because that's just life. That's the experiences that I've had as I've been growing up. That's the genetic predisposition that I've had as a human being. And all these things mashed and mixed together has created the environment that then has led me to the experiences that I've then had with mental illness. And that doesn't just suddenly change. Your experiences don't just suddenly go away. Those emotions don't disappear. But what you do get is a better ability to cope, a better ability to understand, and a better ability to live with it. And that is good health, ultimately.
Yeah, absolutely. And now I say, I've said it many, many times, that obviously there are parts of me that wish that I didn't go through what I went through and that I didn't. But actually, now I don't think I would want my past without it, because it has shaped who I am. It's changed my perspective on things. It's changed my perspective on life. It's changed my understanding of other people. I ultimately think that I wouldn't be doing what I am doing today, helping who I'm helping, being a coach, being a personal trainer, sharing my story. Like, I just think that there isn't anything now that I would change. I am, again, I consider myself very lucky that I've got to this point, because, like, very sadly, I was in hospital with girls that didn't recover, and, anorexia and bulimia and binge eating took their lives. So it's a very serious illness that is taking lives and is still taking lives. But I feel very privileged and very lucky that I am in a position where I've gone through what I've gone through, and I now have this mindset and this perspective on life that, I want to help other people, and I want to encourage people to move for the right reasons, and, to see food in a positive way. I'm very grateful for the experiences that I've had now, and even the way that I approach life, and my kind of, anyone that knows me, my kind of like almost impulsive nature to life of, grabbing things, grabbing opportunities, having these moments where I just say, fuck it, I'm going to do it because life's too short. I don't think I'd have that same mindset if I hadn't have been through what I've been through. And I think it's true what they say, like, when you've danced with death, you've seen how fragile life is, and I've lost friends very close to me to the illness. It's almost given me that drive to kind of live life to the fullest. And it is sad that it's taken me to them, because I think I did kind of coast through before that, and maybe wouldn't have taken opportunities, and maybe my life would have gone in a very different direction. But, because of the experiences that I've had, I think it's definitely shaped who I am as a person, and I wouldn't change that for the world now. Would not change that for the world.
And equally, a lot of people don't get to that point of being able to take those opportunities and be able to say yes to these things and do kind of coast. And I would say that for nearly 40 years that I've been on this planet, that I have coasted for the vast majority of that. Maybe being a little bit harsh myself, I've been pretty successful, but
you've done quite a lot for someone who's coasting.
it's a great insight into kind of the kind of self-belief mindset that I struggle with. I was recently recognized in the Disability Power 100s, which is like this massive thing. I still question myself on whether I've done anything of importance, and whether I've actually added value to the world, because that's ultimately what I want to do. So when I think about what I want to be remembered for, and what the impact that I want to have is improving people's lives in my own little way. But even with those different things going on, and even with knowing that I've literally saved people's lives from talking about things, I still think that I coast, and I still think that it's not good enough. And that, yeah, just that comment is an insight into the kind of dialogue that I often have.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like sort of like the imposter syndrome thing of always feeling like you're not doing enough, but actually it was kind of the analogy that I used to use when I was unwell, in that a person, so I used to always say I'm not sick enough for help, like I don't deserve help, I'm not ill enough. And the doctors in the hospital and the therapists always used to say, if you're in a place to think that you're not sick enough for help, it means you're sick enough for help. No person that was well would say that. And I guess it's kind of the same with that. I think it's the same as in like lazy people always get annoyed for thinking that they're like doing too much. And driven people get annoyed for always thinking that they're not doing enough. And it's true, because I think that the thoughts that you have on yourself and your own self-esteem, which leads a lot into like mental illness as well, is kind of like you just always feel like you're proving yourself. Like I know that I do. I feel like I've always got to prove myself. And if I do well at something, it's always because of someone else or because of a circumstance. Like I used to, you know, do well at school and I'd be like, oh, it was just because the test was easy. Or I just happened to revise that last night. I was just lucky. I never ever went, do you know what? I worked bloody hard and that's why I did well in that test. And, you know, even with recovery, it was kind of always like, yeah, but I don't deserve to be proud of my recovery because I got myself into this situation. I'm the one that stopped eating. So why should I feel proud of myself for starting again? Again, that is an insight into your brain, because I didn't stop eating. I never wanted to stop eating. I've always, because people say this all the time, like, how do you not just love food? And I'm like, I do. Like, there has never been a point in my journey where I didn't want, trust me, I was watching everybody eat. I used to cook for everyone. At the height of my illness, I used to make cakes and everything, and I used to watch people eat them. I loved food. My Instagram reel was just food accounts. You know those ones where they like zoom in on like breaking things apart and the cheese would ooze out? I used to spend my time watching those videos. There has never been a point in my life where I haven't loved food. But when you're mentally unwell, like, you can't overcome that. And it's just that barrier between, again, like what we always say of like, you know, what you think and what is actually going on in someone's head are two very different things. But it is always just that self-esteem that you're not doing enough or you could be doing more. But actually, it's generally the people that are working super hard that think that about themselves, not the ones that aren't actually not doing enough.
Yeah. And just thinking about kind of reflecting and kind of probably kind of thinking about the future to an element as well. One of the questions in this season that I'm asking every guest is that when you're at the end, when you're at the end of your journey, the end of your life, and you're looking back and you're kind of thinking about the things that you've done, you've accomplished, what do you want to be remembered for?
Oh, that's a hard one. I think first and foremost, my goal has always been to help people. And I haven't always realized that, but when I look back at everything that I've done, the times when I've felt most at peace is when I've been helping other people. Every job that I've got myself into without realizing it has been me helping others. And I think especially now with my experiences, like when I look back, if I can look back and someone can say, because of something you said or because of something you posted or because of working alongside you, you know, it stopped me from doing this, or it allowed me to find myself out of a dark space, like that's more than enough for me. I don't really have, I'm very basic when it comes to like materialistic things. Like I don't really have that drive. My goal is just to just, you know, spread that little bit of like hope for people, that I think especially when it comes to sharing my story, that like there is the possibility to recover and there is light at the end of the tunnel. So if one thing I can look back and say that something I said resonated somewhere with someone and it stopped them from, you know, getting into a dark place, or it helped pull them out of a dark place, then that would be enough for me.
Cool. I think we'll have to get you back on, Alice, to talk about all the other things that you would do as well, particularly in the kind of disability training and adaptive fitness. It's been an amazing conversation. I think I've learned things about myself whilst we've been talking, as much as learning so much about your experiences and anorexia and that really important message of the kind of mental illness journey that people go through, and the understanding that the outward expression of what people put out there isn't always the truth, isn't always reality. And I think that's something that we should all take away. So I just want to thank you. Thank you for being open. Thank you for being honest. And thank you for coming onto the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great chat. But yeah, thank you for having me.